Welcome, everyone. Arif Hamid is a newly appointed assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. His lab will open in November this year at the Twin Cities Medical Campus in Minneapolis. He did his postdoc at Brown University with Michael Frank and Chris Moore, which is where he completed the experiments that he will tell us more about today. Before that, he completed his PhD at the University of Michigan with Joshua Burke, where he studied the contributions of dopamine to motivational vigor and reinforcement learning. Welcome, Arif.
Thank you very much, Ethan and Carla. It's a lot of fun to be with you guys and also your audience.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show. When I saw this paper posted on Twitter, I feel like there's a lot of interest in it, and it seemed really exciting. We actually even covered it today in Journal Club in my lab.
Oh, cool.
So I'm really excited to get into it. So it seems like you have a long history studying motivation and reinforcement learning, dating back to your PhD. So could you first please tell us a little bit about what those behaviors are, since our audience is kind of wide ranging, and how maybe a little bit about how they're encoded in the brain and this like debate about whether dopamine solely encodes reward prediction error or whether it also reflects motivation.
Sure, yeah. So I guess maybe I can start by saying, you know, there's a really long-standing appreciation for dopamine's involvement in adaptive and flexible behaviors. And you can really largely think about them as meeting the simultaneous but nonetheless dual requirements of being optimal in the moment, in the present, right now, and also allowing you to be most flexible so your behaviors are adaptive for future decisions that you have to make. And you can kind of broadly classify this to the motivational roles and the reinforcement learning roles. And so now there's a lot of, in my formal talk, I go through like all the pieces of evidence for this, but there's really multiple levels of analysis that has produced evidence for how dopamine can shape, you know, at the cellular and circuit levels, excitability effects in the cortical striatal circuitry that we think map onto the effect of dopamine for online performance and vigor. So the idea is if you have animals or humans take various psychoactive drugs that generally boost levels of dopamine, what happens in the moment is they perform acts with haste and vigor. They perform a lot faster and they have a reduced threshold to do things. So we broadly classify these motivational functions. But there's also kind of a parallel literature that also suggests that dopamine can signal what are called error signals. And much like a thermostat in your house, an error signal is really useful to continuously and adaptively change set points so that you can be a very adaptive agent in the world. And so this learning function of dopamine is fundamentally emphasized the role of dopamine in future behaviors so that you can incorporate environmental feedback now, but that feedback is used for decisions you will make in the future. And so these are really the two contrasting views of dopamine that have for quite a bit of time now have been argued across these theoretical rifts that really emphasize dopamine only does motivation or dopamine only does these learning functions that I just described by relaying these reward prediction error signals. And so these are some of the things that I worked on in graduate school also. During my PhD with Josh Burke at the University of Michigan.
So actually, we'll go back to that. What got you interested in studying dopamine and motivation or reinforcement learning? And how did that kind of inform where you are now and what you're setting up your lab to be?
Sure, yeah. So one really important reason we set out to do the series of experiments we did in grad school that we ended up publishing in 2016 was really this kind of glaring puzzle in this theoretical rift of does dopamine do motivation or does dopamine do learning? The paradoxical puzzle is that, you know, I think so certainly dopamine really does do both. The problem is we just don't have good conceptual frameworks by which we can integrate both simultaneously. And so we developed framework by which dopamine can multiplex learning signals and motivational signals by relaying kind of a motivational value signal within the nucleus accumbens core at the time And we also provide empirical evidence using a fast scan voltammetric methods to measure dopamine in the ventral stratum in the nucleus accumbens core. And so we thought in the conclusion, our studies there, at least restricted to this ventral striatal motivational locus, were providing important clarity in how dopamine can shape both learning and motivational functions simultaneously.
So the question that drives your current paper is, since there are different regions of the striatum that receive different patterns of dopamine input, presumably from the VTA or ventral tegmental area and substantia nigra, all in the midbrain, how do those different patterns observe the different computations that the striatum performs? As you said, there's this like multiplexing. So you point out that it would be inefficient for all those subregions to perform the same computation at the same time, and that'd be redundancy. And that might, you know, in the past has been suggested by world version error studies. So what was your hypothesis going into this work about what might dictate the computational specialty?
Sure, yeah. So it's funny, actually, our initial very first hypothesis was actually quite simple. And it obviously evolved to accommodate for some of the experimental tests and data we ended up acquiring. But at its core, really at the highest level, we really seek to refine this dominant framework for dopamine that we have, which is one that asserts that dopamine is really this, like you mentioned, a global broadcast signal that effectively delivers reward prediction error signals to really huge territories of the postsynaptic striatal subregions. And I just want to give a nod here to how such a broadcast view of neuromodulator systems is actually quite pervasive in neuroscience, because this is also the canonical way we think about ascending serotonergic systems or norepinephrinergic systems and various other modulator systems. We really think of them as switches that deliver a very important signal to really large territories of the striatum. Now, one problem with this such a view of a global, like a broadcast, is that it's really difficult to reconcile it with the functional architecture of the dopamine recipient subregions that we know of. You know, I like to analogize this to the limitations that, for example, a bill that gets signed at the federal level in Congress is really unlikely to work very well for each of the states that this bill is meant to work at. So there's really overwhelming evidence that the dopamine recipient subregions are quite different. We know that the cortical striatal loops can be distinguished into different territories based on the complement of glutamergic inputs they get from the cortex or the thalamus. We know that they have different molecular and genetic cytoarchitectures. And also they're organized into these parallel loops that perform computations at the level of the limbic circuitry, the cognitive subloop, and also the sensory motor subloops that mostly passes through the dorsolateral striatum. So at the broadest level, we really set out to wrestle with this idea that surely dopamine dynamics across these really large territories of striatum are unlikely to be delivering such a uniform and what we call scalar reward prediction error signals to these diverse striatal subregions. And that there must be some circuit specializations that could allow the system to deliver dopamine decision signals that are really most useful for these recipients of regions. And so returning to my analogy, the form of, you know, the Affordable Care Act that may be in practice in Idaho is likely very different from, you know, how it may be administered in California or Rhode Island. It's likely going to depend on and tailored to the needs of the local population. And so this is really at the highest level where we set out with the hypothesis.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So to address this hypothesis, you start by looking at the dopaminergic inputs to the dorsal striatum using wide field recordings of GCAMP, which allows you to look at activity of neurons. And specifically, you're looking at the activity of axons that are delivering the dopamine. And you also, in concert, looked at D-Lite, which is a sensor for dopamine release. and you did this in head fixed mice. So what did you find when you performed this experiment?
Yes, so this was actually the earliest portions of the paper, which I, you know, was super exciting in terms of how I experienced it, because we really made this empirical observation and discovery of these wave-like activation patterns in the response profile of dopamine axons and also dopamine release across very large territories, 60 to 80% of the dorsal surface of the dorsal striatum in this particular case. So these activation patterns were spatiotemporally continuous. They emerge somewhere and they travel somewhere else and then they extinguish in other parts of the striatum. And I really wished I could show your audience a video of this. And I know that it's available either on Twitter and also as part of the paper. But really when I saw these first images and videos, I was completely shocked because we really did not predict these patterns of activity initially.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if that was part of your initial hypothesis or not. That's,
yeah, we, it's funny. We really completely did not expect this. And this was a complete serendipitous finding. We really set out to look across really large territories of the striatum to assess whether or not there are some mechanisms by which you can discreetly deliver dopamine to only some subregions and not others. But this wave, like, response actually relates dopamine activity from one subregion to another. And so that's, I think, what's the really exciting part. I'm sure we'll talk more about as we go on.
Yeah, absolutely. So to follow up on that, you note that the propagation was primarily medial lateral as opposed to anterior posterior. So was there a distinction between the flow that corresponded to axon activity versus the dopamine release, since you had those two indicators that you were using?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. We did throw in a paper largely driven by suggestions from the community to make sure that we didn't only independently observe these wave-like activation patterns in the axonal response and dopamine release, but also to make measurements of both simultaneously, and we did. And at these coarse imaging methods that we used, wide field imaging, we really did not see obvious differences in these response profiles. But I know that the field has some clues that there could be potential epochs where spiking in dopamine axons themselves may be subtly distinguished from release patterns itself. There's a really interesting paper from Dave Seltzer's lab in 2016 that suggested perhaps silent dopaminergic synaptic locations. But we really didn't see kind of very obvious pieces of evidence for something like this. So I think this would get followed up.
So if you could speculate for a moment, and I think you do get to this in your discussion, could any part of this wave-like pattern be attributed to local neurons like medius bunny neurons or the cholinergic interneurons that are present, maybe synapsing onto each other, causing a sort of propagation from one end to the other?
Yeah, no, you're asking some really important questions, which we actually have very direct plans to follow up. I should just say that in the story, once we made the initial observation, we set out to build the story upward by asking how is it involved in behavior and what are the specific computational roles these waves may have. But there are also important questions about how they could be mechanistically generated, which is what you're asking. Now, there are a couple of very interesting competing hypotheses that I don't really know one way or another as we are following up these studies. So one possibility is that, you know, if you rely on the excitation-release coupling framework in neurobiology, suggesting that a spike propagates through the action potentials, and then therefore really causes release from the axon terminals. If you observe, you know, these spatiotemporally continuous wave-like propagation in the dopamine axons and or release, then there must be some explanation at the level of the spiking within the midbrain. So perhaps there could be some order within the midbrain such that topographically projecting dopamine cells may be spiking in some form of a sequence within the midbrain itself, so that you can get sequential recruitment of these dopamine arbors. And then that's, you know, quite likely. Right now, I am really unsure whether that's the case. There's also a second very intriguing hypothesis, because the field, at least at the level of the brain slice studies, have started to demonstrate a variety of mechanisms that you suggested, wherein a spike from the midbrain does not necessarily translate one-to-one to dopamine release within the striatum. So there are these cholinergic mechanisms that have been discovered that operate through nicotinic receptors expressed on dopamine axons that could induce a spike within the axon, within the striatum locally, and cause release independent of spiking within the midbrain. But most recently, there's also been a lot of attention for GABA-A receptors expressed on dopaminergic axons that may be providing shunt currents such that propagating action potentials across the axon itself does not fruitfully and robustly yield to neurotransmitter release in the striatum. And so it'd be really cool if some of one or these two mechanisms could be involved in the spatiotemporal mechanisms that we provide, and perhaps themselves could be leveraged during different epochs of behavior, for example, to be differentially recruited.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's good that you don't cover everything all at once, right? So that you can have more work to do with your own lab.
Yes, for sure. No, we certainly think this is the earliest description of this work. And you know, we think there's such a large body of work that can follow some of our findings.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you alluded to, the next thing that you asked was what would be the role of these waves in behavior? And specifically, you test this in the context of instrumental learning versus Pavlovian learning. So what was previously known, just for viewers or listeners who might not be familiar with this body of literature, about striatal subregions and in the agency of these kinds of behaviors like instrumental learning versus Pavlovian learning?
Sure, yeah. So maybe I would just also take a moment to articulate our experimental approach as to how we set out to test this broader hypothesis that I articulated earlier, which is that perhaps there are spatiotemporal specializations that allow dopamine to deliver regional decision signals that may be relevant for this underlying striatal subregions themselves. So what we did is we wanted to test this hypothesis by using what we already know in the literature of what the underlying specialty of the dorsal striatum itself is. So we know that the dorsal striatum has a really nice graded behavioral specialization. The more medial portions of the subregion is really enriched for with neural representations for action outcome contingencies. So the circuit is really continuously making predictions about I'm in control of rewards. Now, this is called agency learning in the field broadly, wherein animals and humans really try to understand how they affect the world, especially in terms of achieving desired goals. So if you, some of the evidence that props up this hypothesis is really that if you inactivate this dorsal medial striatal subregion or you block dopamine transmission there, animals have a focal deficiency in learning about agency. They're not really good at learning that rewards in the world are really under their instrumental control. And so so given this background knowledge, what we tried to do was to design task demands we thought that would recruit these dorsal medial striatal subregions differentially based on reward controllability and assess whether or not dopamine locally within these dorsal medial striatal subregions itself is also differentially modulated by these task specialty that the striatal subregion cares about. Or conversely, perhaps dopamine is really relaying some global signal that is indifferent of task specialty or controllability. And so we designed a couple of task variants, one in which animals were, these head posted animals were able to walk on a wheel to pursue these distant rewards by through their actions. And we'll call these instrumental trials. And then there's also a variant, which we call Pavlovian trials, where rewards are really not linked to how much the animals expend effort. And so mere passage of time, for example, would deliver rewards to these animals. And so so because of this task design, we're able to test our hypothesis as to whether or not dopamine cares about regional task specialty. And because dopamine reward prediction errors at reward outcome provide a kind of a credit of a reward that needs to be dispensed to different parts of the striatum as to whose predictions were most accurate. So one prediction at the end of this behavioral test is really to assess whether or not the dorsomedial striatum will get a big reward prediction error signal only under instrumental trial conditions and not in the Pavlovian trial conditions. And so we find results that are consistent with this, but instead of, you know, spatially discrete dopamine reward prediction errors at reward, what we actually observed were these wave-like patterns that had opponent directions going from the medial striatum out towards the lateral striatum or reversing directions. You know, I'll just end by saying that it's really important to recognize that these wave directions were actually very important in regulating the temporal delay of dopamine arriving at different parts of the striatum. And so, because if a wave initiates in the more medial striatum, it provides the earliest increase in dopamine right at the more medial parts, and then progressively delayed increases relative to the reward to the more lateral parts. And then we found that these are dynamically reversed across trials.
Were you surprised that the other regions that I guess previously hadn't been thought to be involved in those behaviors were still activating just at a later point? So for instance, the lateral regions being involved are still activating in response to the Pavlovian delivered reward, and the more medial parts responding to the reward being delivered during the instrumental part of the task.
Yeah, you point to a really interesting result, actually. So we think these results are quite consistent with some of the hypotheses that we're testing, but there are also very subtle differences in the details of what we actually predicted. So as far as the dorsomedial striatum is concerned, we found that opponent waves under instrumental and Pavlovian conditions were really delivering peaks in dopamine that were temporally delayed relative to reward delivery. And we interpret these as delivering reward credit to and away from the dorsomedial striatum region through this delay mechanism. But as you point out, there are also these lateral portions of the striatum that in the literature have been described to care a little bit more about Skinnerian sensory motor associations or habitual type learning behaviors, which don't necessarily agree with some of the overt predictions that we made. But if we actually go back a little bit to some of the slice studies that actually help connect our wave-like dynamics to changes in regional plasticity mechanisms, there's a really beautiful study from the Kasai group in 2014 that was published in Science that demonstrated that if you take, this is a brain slice study, if you take a glutamergic input arriving at one dendritic spine of a D1 MSN, and you provide this pre and postsynaptic recruitment by depolarizing the postsynaptic cell, and you deliver dopamine, optogenetically induced dopamine transients, what they found is that the amount of plasticity you induce at the synapse really cares about the delay of dopamine arriving relative to this pre-postsynaptic input. And so this was a really important link for us in terms of how dopamine waves could be potentially driving regional plasticity signals. But because there is a very steep fall off in this kernel, temporal kernel of how dopamine can shape plasticity, we reasoned that these opponent wave directions would still drive plasticity across the entire network, but rather provide kind of a regionally weighted or or a normalized plasticity signal that can be used for learning across these stratal subregions.
Yeah, and that's very consistent with what you found with when you were dynamically switching between instrumental versus Pavlovian, sort of this encoding of learning that they're now in this new task, so the new plasticity.
Exactly, for sure. And then that's also an additional task manipulation that we provided, wherein we trained animals within a session and we forced them to learn these contingencies dynamically, where we exposed them to 20 to 30 trials of instrumental condition, blocks of trials that had instrumental contingencies, and then Pavlovian, and then instrumental, and so forth. So these animals dynamically adjusted their behaviors. And the wave directionality was also reflected, as you just indicated. And we found that as additional evidence suggesting that not only does dopamine care about which contingency the animal is in, but by doing very specific analysis as to how past wave directions affect how much animals tend to run or not run on future trials, we're able to link wave directionality with the behavioral flexibility of these animals, suggesting that these waves are indeed used for reinforcement learning across these blocks too.
So if you constructed this really elegant mixture of experts model that makes predictions about how dopamine encodes both performance and learning, could you just briefly walk us through that model and like what that looks like?
One really important set of computational challenges that motivates the model that the model that we ended up using is really this parallel architecture of the cortical basal ganglia circuitry provides really interesting challenges during the performance and the outcome epochs. And if you will consider that because the cortical basal ganglia circuits are composed of subregions of the striatum that themselves make predictions about and vote for different potential action plans that the animal could pursue. During the performance epoch, there's a very interesting challenge that the circuit at a higher level gets faced with, which we call the circuit inference problem, which is the brain needs to determine of these voters, which subregion is voting with the most accurate action policy. So like whose predictions are most accurate and therefore should control the behavioral outputs of the animal. And when the animal and the agent gets to the reward itself, then there's also this related challenge because a reward prediction error arrives and the brain is now faced with who should I pass this reward credit to? And so this we call the spatiotemporal credit assignment problem. And to really understand the dynamics of dopaminergic signals that help resolve some of these structural inference and credit assignment challenges. So we have a mixture of experts model, which is trying to decide whether or not to run in this task, and if so, how far along. And this agent really relies on sub-experts that it contains, which are themselves tuned to building and accruing evidence for whether or not the agent's motoric outputs are really predicting rewards, or whether or not a mere passage of time are really predicting reward contingencies. Moreover, each of these distant and time experts also contain subordinate sub-experts that themselves specialize in very specific contingencies. And so the idea is really that experience with a single trial will allow each of the sub-experts that are within each of these distant and time experts to build and continuously accumulate evidence as to how accurate their predictions are as the agent gains a more and more experience within a single trial. And so one advantage of this model is that it makes predictions at multiple levels that we were able in the paper to unpack and connect with dopaminergic transmission, both during the anticipation epoch and also the outcome epoch.
And in figure 7, you talk about some of how the reward prediction errors factor into that model.
Exactly, yes. So at the lowest level of the model, for example, we think that each of these sub-experts in the model that correspond to smaller territories of ensembles of cells within the striatum, we think as the agent experiences a sensory state transition, which this particular subagent had not predicted very effectively, that subregion would experience a transient reward prediction error signal, what we call a sub-expert prediction error signal. And a bunch of these sub-experts, as they continue to test these predictions, to compare these sensory experiences against their predictions, will also experience a variety of these reward prediction error signals. And so we're able in the paper to just as a first pass demonstrate that these sub-expert prediction error signals are actually present in localized subregions of the striatum. But I think future follow-up work will really try to assess how they're related to these ramp-like increases across the broader striatal subregion that we demonstrated in earlier figures will be.
So as we've talked about your paper, sort of going through the different figures and some of the main findings that you came away with, can you contextualize this finding in the context of this rift between motivation and reward prediction error that you brought up at the beginning of our conversation?
Yes, sure. So this is really what we continued to provide additional clarity for. So at least our paper, by linking how these spatiotemporal activation patterns of the dopamine waves are indeed involved for resolving these spatiotemporal credit assignment problems at reward outcome, and that during reward pursuit itself, we suggested that dopamine may be helping with this voting process by providing a spatiotemporal, helping to resolve a spatiotemporal inference problem. We think that dopamine can still do its dual operations, largely driven by the excitability effects to affect ongoing voting and performance, and also through the plasticity effects at reward outcome to drive region-specific plasticity. And so taken together, our work is really providing a mechanism by which you can vectorize or reweight these performance signals across different striatal subregions, or these learning signals across striatal subregions. And I'm sure follow-up work will continue to provide additional clarity.
You may have just underscored this question, but you know, what is one thing that you hope readers of your paper will walk away with?
Yeah, so you know, I think the key aspect is really to try to move past this notion that dopamine is a scalar unitary signal across really large territories of the striatum. And I think once we move past this notion, we'll be able to make very direct connections between a lot of the recent mechanistic understandings that we have about local modulation of dopamine, for example, and how they could be related to dopaminergic dynamics that could be leveraged differentially for behavioral flexibility.
Thank you. And we have two more questions on the training side of things, but before we get to those, is there anything that you wish we had asked you that we haven't covered so far?
No, I think this was actually a really a thorough set of questions. Although maybe what I'll suggest, maybe what I'll just back up and talk about are these ramp-like dynamics that we provided during the anticipation epoch. So because we found opponent wave directions at reward outcome, we also wanted to understand how dopamine expressed across the dorsal striatum during reward expectation may also be important for how reward credit gets delivered to different parts of the striatum. So we empirically found that, for example, during the instrumental task, these more medial parts of the striatum get an evolving ramp up of dopamine selectively during the instrumental task, and they get progressively ramped down of dopamine during the Pavlovian task. And we interpret these opponent ramp directions that are themselves spatiotemporally expressed as relaying some kind of online evidence of how accurate the predictions of that underlying subregion is for the overall goal or pursuit of this animal. And so going back to what I said a moment ago, the dorsal medial striatus region is generating predictions for amine control, amine control, amine control. And so in the instrumental task, as the animal performs more of this trial and receives sensory evidence that it indeed is in control, dopamine ramps to that subregion are likely to provide these accuracy signals that allow that subregion to control the behavioral output of this animal. By contrast, in the Pavlovian condition, however, the predictions of this subregion that are continuing to be amine control, although the sensory evidence is providing evidence against the computations this subregion is performing, dopamine there is now relaying how inaccurate the subregion computations are. And so our interpretation is that during the anticipatory epoch, dopamine is really providing how information about how valuable the prediction of this underlying subregion is for the goals of the animal. And that at reward outcome, dopamine wave now comes in to provide the reward credit across a different strata subregions.
We mentioned at the start of the episode that you were about to start your own lab in November.
Yes, that's true.
What was your experience on the job market like, you know, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, I did. I was on the job market during a COVID year, but actually, all things considered, I really had a wonderful time. You know, the job search involves like lots of deep interactions with multiple communities that universities that, you know, have different priorities for different things. And so it was really fun for me to learn about those priorities and assessing how well they end up matching my own short-term and long-term goals. And it was also really awesome to meet so many people that think deeply about various subjects. So I think ultimately I was successful in getting an independent position, which is itself you know, no small feat, but I also recognize how lucky and supported I was because both from my past mentors and also future colleagues that provided me with a lot of clarity in terms of how to navigate at this really critical decision-making point.
And you wound up at such a dopamine-focused university, it seems like, right? Or decision-making, especially.
Yes, I was hired into a medical discovery team on addiction, which is really trying to make a really strong, which is trying to make a progress in understanding the basic molecular multi-level really mechanisms of how drug abuse end up hijacking brain systems to produce this disorder. And there's so much interactions that I will hope to, and I think we'll have with these labs that I'm really excited to be at.
May I also ask, in terms of priorities, was there any priority in particular that you were looking for?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I think one of the more important aspects for in terms of the environment I was looking for was really how well everybody got along and were collaborative in terms of how well they nurture trainees at multiple levels, at the undergrad level, at the grad school student level, and also the postdoc level, but also how well you know, junior faculty end up getting a mentorship from the more senior faculty. I think different schools, I think, do it differently. Not that one's better than another, but there were just really interesting outlooks that I thought were very appealing for me at the University of Minnesota.
Nice. And finally, our last question. So many of our listeners are trainees. Do you have any advice for, you know, science up and comers as you enter this stage of your career?
Sure, yeah. You know, maybe I would suggest, you know, continuing to be optimistic about, you know, their future outlook and keep the ideas and promise of having impact through scientific discovery. I think that's really, really important. And I realized the road itself can be arduous at times in terms of, you know, finding funding or the just temporally extended nature of scientific pursuit itself. And so I think this is where, you know, mentorship and horizontal relationships become important, and finding communities that, you know, embrace and cultivate curiosity and hard work. And I think on an individual level, on a, you know, shorter timescale, I think perhaps like keeping, continuing to sharpen your tools so you can have more impact in whatever it is that you're doing. You know, this means, you know, reading a lot and reading widely and making sure you get and make time to think deeply. Of course, in addition to, you know, learning from your failed experiments so one can course correct. But I'll also add that I think one of the more important aspects actually is to continue to pay it forward, to support and mentor and stimulate more junior scholars. You know, it won't be long before we are the older generation and the, you know, the promise of future discoveries really lies in passing down this torch and making sure our academic cultures and institutions are really healthy and thriving. So I just want to make sure that people also continue to train the next generation.
So thank you for taking the time to explain that to us and our listeners. Where can our listeners find you if they have questions about the paper, or if they want to get in touch?
Sure. Yeah. No, I just want to say thank you very much for the invite. I really had a good time. If anybody has, you know, follow-up questions, I'm also recruiting at multiple levels for my laboratory. If anybody finds some of the stuff that I described interesting, you can reach me at arifhamid.da@gmail.com or also on Twitter at Arif A. Hamid. And I'll be really eager to continue our discussions.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you guys very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.